Right, so welcome. This is the class on pitfalls. Our purpose here this morning is to identify common areas that challenge, especially beginning teachers. But I found that these aren't necessarily a challenge just for beginning teachers. They're a challenge for all teachers. The Bible talks about sins of youth and things that relate that more and more characterized by youth. But that doesn't mean that when you become an old man, that type of temptation is removed. It just means that these are especially characteristic of youth. One of the best ways to stay out of pitfalls is to be able to say, there it is, stay out, right? That's one of the best ways to stay out of pitfalls, is to be able to identify them. Back in the early days of the American automobile, hospitals began to see injuries coming in from the automobile, right? And one of those injuries was repeated over and over and over again. It was so typical that people in the hospital were saying, what's happening out there? Well, it so happens that what was happening out there was when people cranked their Model T, it would kick, it would backfire, and that handle would suddenly go the other direction, and it would rip the thumb, because of the way you were holding the crank, it would rip your thumb, break your thumb. And that particular type of injury became so common that they called it in hospitals a Ford fracture. I remember we had at home an Alice Chalmers B that had an electric start that was quite temperamental, so it also had a crank under the seat. And my dad never allowed me to crank until I was quite old, but he said you always have to hold it with your thumbs out of the road. Get your thumbs out of the way. Otherwise, you're going to have, in this case, an Alice fracture.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing, kind of interesting to think about it, that we have many, many different teachers who are going into many different settings, but yet we can actually talk about Ford fractures. We can talk about the things that are common experiences. And so that's what we'd like to do. And notice that your worksheet this morning is not so super busy. If anybody needs one of these, let your need be known. I think there's some extras in the back there. What I'm intending to do here is I'm intending to identify four common pitfalls. And then I like to just develop those pitfalls by specific examples that show we are indeed in that particular pothole or pitfall. So you've been getting a lot of information this week, and sometimes maybe one of the pitfalls that a beginning teacher has is we got to write all this stuff down. Well, I'll just tell you, you're probably not going to go, let's see, where is that paper? Oh, yes. April, yeah, August 8th. That's not quite going to be the way it works in real life. What we're more doing here in these classes, although it's good to write it down, what we're more doing is framing our mindset, our teacher view, our worldview, because out of that we teach. And so when we are going down the road of teaching and here's a pothole, a pitfall, why, just maybe an alarm bell ring back there and not that you can say, oh, yes, I remember hearing that at WFTI at 10:20 in the morning and so on. Right here it is on my notes. It's not really about that. But it is true that writing things down does help us remember, so it's not a bad idea to take notes. But in this session especially, I've just designed a worksheet that's pretty basic. Pretty basic. Were I to try to tell you, or were you to try to tell me, all the pitfalls between here and Harrisburg, if you were to get in this little car out here outside the window, it would be quite a story, would it not? Mm-hmm. And so that's why, you know, we can't say it all. It's been said there's really only one thing that's standing upright, but there's 1,000 ways to fall. And that is the truth. And we're not here to identify all those 1,000, but we are here to identify the east and the west and the north and the south, as far as directions that you can fall. So to get started, the first one is a faulty self-concept. A faulty self-concept. When you're a teacher, you're kind of up front. Did you notice that, or are you thinking about that? Yeah. And so, you know, we become a little bit more aware of ourselves. And so then the way we think about ourselves is going to dictate how we project ourselves and how we interact with the students. So here are some areas that would indicate that we probably aren't thinking quite right about ourselves. And I'm just going to be real, real utilitarian here. This is not going to be esoteric. This is not going to be lofty, okay? Potholes, pitfalls usually have some slime and mud in the bottom. Okay, so here we go. If you feel like you need to apologize too much, perhaps you're not thinking quite right about yourself. It is right to apologize. Many of these areas, there's a balance here, okay? And I'll just say right up front, I'm not going to always... Now, the balance, okay? I'm going to trust you in your thinking, intelligent people. You can understand this thing of balance. I remember way back in my childhood, we had a Sunday school teacher. She was a very young lady and very sincere. But I think she apologized an average of at least 4 times a minute, the entire week, every evening, the whole hour that we were there. Everything was, oh, I'm sorry, or she'd start saying something and then she wanted to change a little bit. You know how that goes. I didn't predicate that with I'm sorry. Everything was, I'm sorry this, I'm sorry that, I'm sorry the other thing. I remember it yet today. She didn't have to be that sorry, right? There's no need to announce your mistakes. There's no need to announce your faults, your phobias, your weaknesses. There's a certain amount of, if you're going to be successful in teaching, there's a certain amount of setting the plow, setting the destination, and then tapping the horse, and then just plodding along behind it. And if you trip over a root, if you feel like you're working the horse a little too hard, back off. That's okay. You don't have to apologize to the horse and so on. Right? Just do it. Right? Here's a quote that I read, and again, just for what it's worth. If you have a problem, either you can do something about it, or you can't help it. If you can help it, then do. If you can, then you don't need to apologize. Right? There's some things we just need to live with, too. Okay. Now, of course, not apologizing could be another pitfall, but we're going to move on. I'm sorry. I forgot. I really apologize for this. Most of this comes from a chapter in this book. If you don't have this book, it's a great resource for teachers. You can open this book practically anywhere. And it really invites browsing in that regard. And the thing that makes this book so stellar is the index. If you're having a problem about recess, you're having a problem with students bickering on the. I'm sorry, I'm getting off track. You can look in the index and find what to do about students that are bickering on the playground. All right? And if you can't find it with looking 3 minutes in the index, it's not in the book. Because the index is just that good and that user-friendly. Okay. So this is chapter 48. And get this book and read chapter 48. All right, moving on. Another problem or where a faulty self-concept might show itself is if we want to be liked too much by the students. Yes, you want to be friendly with the students, but you can't be their best friend. In fact, you can't be the best friend and teacher both. It just doesn't work that way. There's a lot that has been argued and discussed about this. And I remember talking with a young man the first or second year of WFTI, and he was really promoting this thing in a way that I felt uncomfortable about, that you got to be a friend to your students. But yet I couldn't deny him his sincerity and his desire. I couldn't deny his premise. I think the thing that separates a teacher from a friend is the fact that friends don't give friends grades. Okay? But if you're my student, I'm going to give you grades. And I'm going to say right here is where you made the mistake. Mm-hmm. And there may be times I'm going to say, I got a paper back from my friend, but she was also my teacher. It said on the top of the paper, Jonathan, do you know what you lack? Effort! Big letters, right? And I wrote a note back to her, and it says, Dear Sister Judy, I do not want to lack effort. And I've redone the paper without anybody telling me what to do. We're talking about teacher-student interaction there, aren't we? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that, however many years ago that was, 30-something, 30X. She was relating to me as a teacher. Friends don't evaluate friends in the way that teachers evaluate their students. Okay? I think if you can keep that in mind, you can be a friend to your student, but you can also be a teacher to your student. Another area of faulty self-concept has to do with getting discouraged. We're here trying to prime you, pump you up, get you equipped, and you're very eager for all those things to happen. And I thank you and I praise you for that. But when you get into the real life, you're going to find out that there are going to be things and events that are going to give you your comeuppance real quick. It's not all that clean in real life. It's not so sterile. It's a little messy. And the situations you encounter, they're going to break all these principles and all these rules and all these situations we talked about. They're going to break slightly off center. It's not going to hit the target dead on exactly what we've been talking about. And it's going to be a little confusing. And so it isn't too long. Typically, it's not too long when a teacher starts teaching that they have to face discouragement. And oftentimes, it has to do with a faulty self-concept. I can't do this. I've been thinking wrong. I'm messed up. I'm incapable. I can't teach. In fact, I remember my first year, I went out for a restroom break, notes this. And that's exactly what I told God. I said, God, I'm sorry, I can't do this. I don't know why I ever said I can. Just get me through this year. No, make that today. Get me through today, and I'll not be so foolish again. Right? And I went to teach for 15 more years after that. I think you get the idea that things that go wrong in your classroom don't necessarily mean that you're incapable, don't necessarily mean that you're a bad person, don't necessarily mean that now's the time to roll around in the dirt and tell God I'm through, I'm done, don't count on me anymore, we're going to hand this off to somebody else. No. Closer related would be letting the little things, the little ups and downs, discourage us. School teaching is a skill. And it's a little bit like I get in my mind's eye, I can see a seal balancing a ball on its nose. And there's this balance, and there's this wobbling around. But we praise a seal that can actually do that. We actually pay big money to see them doing that. But what about all the wobble? I mean, there's really a significant amount of wobble in that whole scenario. So it is with your classroom. So it is when you're working with people. There's a significant amount of wobble. Some days you go home and you feel like, yee-haw, we are on the path. We just praise the Lord for walking us into this amazing opportunity. And then there's some days that we go home and we don't even want to see it fading in the back mirror, in the rear view mirror. We're looking ahead. We're headed out of here, right? Ups and downs are okay. There can be significant wobble, and it's okay. It has nothing to do with our competence. And when there is failure, when the ball actually falls off the nose and bounces into the mud, well then, again, remember that failure is an event. It's not a person. Just because you're experiencing failure doesn't mean that you're a failure. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means that now you've learned something for next time. We're talking about self-concept. Failure is not a person, it's an event. Oh, by the way, that's the way it is for success too. All right, here's another pitfall, or maybe an indication that we're in the pitfall of a faulty self-concept. And that is feeling too responsible for the students. Feeling too responsible for the students. A teacher's work is that of a sympathetic guide. And so when I think of this thing of a sympathetic guide, I think about the books I read about mountain climbing. If I'm too fat and ill-shapen to make it to the top of Mount Everest, is it the Sherpa's fault? No. It's not the Sherpa's fault. He might feel bad that he didn't get me to the top. But there's only, a Sherpa can only pull on the rope so hard. You know. And the same it is with a teacher. You as a teacher, your responsibility is to be a sympathetic guide in this climb to learning. And so we cannot feel too responsible and feel that failing grade is solely my responsibility. Another place this plays out sometimes is there are times that, well, students might be taken out of school for whatever reason. My first year of teaching, we had a family that was a homeschooling family, sent their children to school, and they took them all out one day, whoosh. And not that we didn't know that anything was brewing, but we certainly didn't expect that. I felt so bad. I mean, I got the call mid-morning from the principal saying, Joseph isn't at school today, is he? I said, no. They said, well, he's not coming. In fact, he won't be back. And maybe it would have been better if the principal would have called at a different time. I don't know, but I could hardly face it. I could hardly go back into my classroom because I felt so responsible for his absence. I just felt like I had failed the family. I had failed the boy. I was actually failing the church because, you know, all this is kind of part of a package in our settings. But it really wasn't my decision. I found out later that one of the straw that broke the camel's back was the fact that I had given an assignment where they were to study out of the Martyr's Mirror. And they took offense at the gore in the Martyr's Mirror. I don't mind a parent that has a concern about that. That really isn't my issue. In a conservative Anabaptist school, guess what we might be doing in the upper grades? So, there. I can look back at that with far more objectivity. But I'm giving a demonstration of feeling too responsible for the students. Here's another pitfall that has to do with our self-image or maybe our self-concepts about ourselves, and that is being a perfectionist. Your classroom does not have to look like a story for the Wee Lambs papers for it to be successful. It really doesn't. We talked about that before. I told you that life is inherently messy, and that's okay. Teaching and training children, it is slow progress. And you need to be long-suffering and those kind of things. If you need to see results to go to bed and feel happy about the day, maybe school teaching isn't for you. Do your sustainable best. I cringe a little bit when I hear this encouragement to do your best. Teachers shouldn't do that with their students either. I don't think we're looking for the best. I think we're looking for the sustainable best. I'll bet that I could get Aaron here to hang off of that bent by his teeth. I bet he could do that almost. if the stick were long enough, you know, and if I raised the ante high enough, right? Do your best, Aaron. Clamp down. Come on. Otherwise, I'm going to, whatever. I'll give you $100,000. Our best and our sustainable best are two different things. Okay? We need to do our sustainable best. Working, a student that works every day to get 100% is going to be spending 80% of their time on that last 5%. You know. And so that's why we need to work towards our sustainable best. You can't hang from your teeth indefinitely. I could probably do it for a short amount of time too, even though I do have this bubble here, right? But in the right circumstances, right? You're not doing your best unless you're hanging by your teeth. No. Right? Do your sustainable best, right? Another common mistake of beginning teachers that has to do with self-image, faulty self-concepts is resisting advice. Resisting advice. There was a situation of which I was aware where a young lady did what many young ladies will be doing this fall. They moved out of their community to another community to teach. She knew how to do it. And she actually was pretty good at it. But there were some flaws that were potentially, could be fatal in some of the things that were happening in her classroom. So her board approached her about it, as good boards should, and she did not receive their advice. And they were a little alarmed because as time continued, they were indeed right. And train crashes were happening. And so they went to her again and said, do you not see this train crash? Do you not see this, that train crash? And so on. We've been telling you, trying to tell you, and she was like, no, it's okay. I'm comfortable with this. See, and I know this ain't going to work. And finally, they called her former teacher, whom she was in high admiration of and probably been the one that helped her get into teaching in many direct and indirect ways. And the board called him and said, can you call her and try to help us along here? So he called her and she would not hear him. And finally, he said something like this. She said, sister, if you aren't willing to listen to those who you're working for, if you're not willing to those who have traveled this road for more years than you have, I have no hope to offer you. She was sent home before Thanksgiving. Right? One time I was asked to help give one teacher some advice who was struggling with a particular class. And we got absolutely that far. My fingers are together. Mm-hmm. Right? And it was particularly on this issue. He said, what you've got to realize is that I had a different teacher every year that I went to school. And I have learned from every single one of them. And what you're seeing in me is the embodiment of all their good points. He actually was an intelligent guy. Not so different than you. And me. All right? Okay. Let's move on. The second blank there is about ignorance of technique. Ignorance of technique. Davey, are you done with this?
Thank you.
Suppose you had never seen a mug before. What a horrible life. And you've never seen a straw before. And you go, okay, mug, straw. Yeah, I've read about this. I've heard that they are supposed to be helpful. Well, that's dumb. We act like that in life. Ignorance of technique. See, I was putting the straw in broadside. It's never going to work that way. Right? And then what I end up doing? Saying dumb straw. Right? Instead of saying dumb me. Right? That's what I should be saying. Ignorance of technique is kind of like that. You heard about the man that had his first banana. And after he was done eating it, someone asked him, well, what did you think? Well, he said he didn't think it was too bad. He said he thought it was a little tough, had a lot of core. But, yeah, maybe it's okay. How are you eating your bananas? Here would be an example of ignorance of technique. And that is, sometimes I think teachers expect the books, and they expect the gadgets, and they expect the props to do all the teaching, when really, it's the teacher who does the teaching. And all these things are just the tools. The tools don't do the teaching. Don't go out and buy a computer and get Excel loaded onto it and say, hey, now I'm a teacher. Baloney. Go eat a banana peel. Right? Mm-hmm. Beware of overdosing on electronics. And even books. You know, we can get the idea that, hey, I'm just a teacher. The book, you know, what number does it say on the spine? 7. He's in 7th grade. He ought to be able to get this. Right? Well, when things don't go right, remember who gets the blame. It won't be your fancy computer. Right? You're going to get the blame. Right? It's not the books. It's not the gadgets. It's entirely appropriate that the teacher gets the blame. Another one that has to do with ignorance of technique would be a faulty sequencing of our class presentation. Are you going to teach every lesson in your room? Some lessons don't even need to be taught. In fact, some lessons should not be taught. The book, The 7 Laws of Teaching, which is going to be addressed later on today, would say you shouldn't be telling students things that they should be able to get on themselves. After all, what is the goal of education? It's to teach people how to learn how to learn. That's the goal of elementary education, right? And so if you think that every math class needs to start by you reverently reading the verse underneath the title for that math lesson, and you have to start there every single day, read that verse by all means. No, we're kind of missing it here. Right? That verse is there. That verse is important. Scriptures are important. That's not the point. The point is that sometimes all you have to do is check in and say, sir, did you get your math lesson going? Because it ought to be part of your policy that they get started before you came to them in class anyway. As a policy that seemed to work well, the longer I used it, I would not have a class in math or language or history until they had read the lesson themselves first. Mm. And what does it do? Well, it's honoring that whole business of teaching a student to learn on their own, right? And so I actually gave a little bit of extra credit if they had started their work and were getting the answers correct. I mean, 1 or 2 points of extra credit for, you know, 3 or 4 problems done correctly. Is that okay? Does that mess up the report card? Well, it doesn't mess it up. It pushes it up. But it jolly well can and should, because a student is doing the very thing that schools are for, right? They're learning how to learn. It's amazing what that 1 or 2% will do to a 4th grader or a 7th grader or a 9th grader in being motivated to learn on their own, right? So these are the things. We're talking about the sequence of class presentation. We're talking about how to actually, you know, have classes and relate to students and relate to our responsibilities of teaching. But we do, after all, have a fairly well-defined curriculum that's not written for you. It's written for the student. Okay? Maybe another error that's often made in the sequence of class preparation is jumping directly into the new concept, especially on a skills lesson, a skills-based lessons like math. All right, folks, here's your new lesson today. It is on dividing by fractions. And immediately we go into the first point is you have to use the reciprocal. Right? All this is true. All this is wonderful, good knowledge. But if we would only review multiplication of fractions first, it would be such a wonderful lead-in. And we'd have everybody following behind us like little ducks follow their mother. And then all we have to do to teach today's lesson is say, all you have to do is this, right? I'm going to teach today's lesson now. That's called the reciprocal. Done. So if you're there pounding on reciprocals and they're only halfway warm to the idea of multiplying fractions, why? You see what's happening. It's a pitfall that we often fall in. Use the review of previous concepts as a springboard for today's lesson. Here's another pitfall that relates to ignorance of technique. One of the techniques that teachers use to accomplish the goal of education is assigning lessons, assigning work. And there's two sides of the ditch here. The one is too much work. The other is, you say it, not enough work, too little work. All right. So assigning not enough or too much. I think we can imagine the results of too much work. We're going to have discouraged students. We're going to have parents that are a little unhappy. And the learning really isn't going to be occurring because they're sweating it out too hard. I think we know the results of not enough work. The classroom isn't on task because there's not tasks for them to be on. And the discipline problems go up. And at the end of the year, the achievement tests aren't saying what the board wants them to say and what they indeed should say, because we haven't had the students engaged in worthwhile work enough. Another ignorance of technique would be giving poor questions. Our well-developed curriculum takes care of a lot of this. But sometimes you can sit in a classroom and you see a teacher give a question that it's too open-ended and the students aren't really sure where to go with it. And what the teacher does next is uses a technique that is indeed appropriate sometime, but it's ignorant in this case. And they start cracking the whip. And you're not quite sure, well, no, wait a minute. Were they wanting to go here or were they wanting to go there? Where are we going with this question? Am I making myself sort of clear, or do I have you in a fog yet? Okay? So let's be sure that our questions are concise. It's well expected as far as, you know, we can keep people with us. Our questions should not be that which makes a frazzled feeling. A question should be that which brings people together, not pushing minds apart. Ignorance of technique. Here's another technique or ignorance of technique that perhaps can be a problem, and that is not getting enough feedback from the class. I feel a little bit conspicuous about this one because this is mainly a lecture. There's some reasons for that we'll not get into. We're targeting first-year teachers. That's the main reason why. But not getting enough feedback from the class. I went to one school, and in the first week, I was pretty hard on the students for not doing the correct assignment. I didn't assign the entire lesson, and my policy was I'd read it at the beginning of the day, and I help the students get their tablet set up. Is this thing of dictation is that a life skill that ought to be learned, to be able to write something down and manage what you write down? Well, of course it is for upper graders. And so in the upper grades, I was saying, all right, your assignment today in math, seventh grade is blah, 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 eighth grade, blah, 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 and so on. And then they come to school the next day, instead of having blah, 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 done, it's blah, blah, blee. You know, where did that come from? Well, that's what you said the assignment was. How many else? And we had, it was kind of like herding cats. Herding, not hurting. Just this whole thing, I mean, I didn't have any problem with this as a school that I'd come from. And then I realized that one of the parents told me, the students don't get your accent. Do I have an accent? You got to be kidding me. You know what I mean? See, I didn't have that. What am I talking about? Not getting enough feedback. Oh, yeah. So what I found out, all I need to do is just give the assignment, then have one of them repeat it. All right? Problem resolved. And it wasn't too long until they got used to my accent. One time, one of my students asked me, this was at the same school, he said, why do you give grades in art? And I was really glad they had asked that question, very good question, because I knew that they weren't very happy that I was grading their art projects, and I knew that the teacher before them wasn't grading their art. And I thought that I'm going to bring some structure to this whole thing, some discipline and so on, so I'm going to give grades in art. And so this fifth grader asked me, why do we give grades in arts? And I said, why, for an incentive for you. And he didn't say anything. He just kept, cutting out the sailboat, whatever. And a little while later, he had worked up enough nerve to ask. Mm-hmm. What's an incentive? All right. See, I hadn't gotten anywhere with him at all. And so it had to do with I should have been asking him, does that make sense? You know what an incentive is? That would have been a great thing. Answer the question with the question. You know what an incentive is? An incentive is that which makes you want to try, that which makes you want to work harder, that which gives reward for work well done and so on. But I hadn't had that exchange. Here's another indication that perhaps we're a little bit ignorant of technique. That would be pressuring students without directing them. Pressuring students without directing them. And the first job that I had when I got out of school was working for a carpenter. We framed houses. We did roofing and carpentry, that type of thing. His most beloved phrase was, just do it. That's the way he gave us instructions. See that? See this? Just do it. Just do it. I got so frustrated with just do it. Teachers, we can do that too. I remember, I believe it was about seventh grade, there was an exercise that we hadn't yet studied in English that related to prepositional phrases, and it was assuming that they had some acumen, they had some aggregate knowledge to draw on to be able to do this exercise. And this one boy raises his hand and says, I don't know what a prepositional phrase is. I said, you really don't need to know all that much, just do it. Said you ought to be able to know. I mean, see the example in the lesson. See right there, it's like that example. So see here they're using prepositional phrases. What you're really supposed to be is not focusing on prepositional phrases. Focus on choosing the correct adjective or whatever, you know. And a little while later, I don't know what a prepositional phrase is. And my response, shame on me, was, why don't you just do it? This isn't creating a problem for anybody else in the class. Just do it. And the reason it's not creating a problem for anyone else in the class is because they're not focusing on this thing of prepositional phrases. They're focusing on this exercise, which is about adjectives. Don't worry so much about the prepositional phrase. Just do it. Well, I soon realized that I'm getting nowhere fast, right? Except I am producing a lot of frustration. Not only in him, but also in me. Right? We're talking about ignorance and technique. I know it can be frustrating when students aren't getting it, but it just might not be his fault. You as a teacher are supposed to possess that link to the unknown and the known, and you're supposed to point out that link as a sympathetic, you know, as that sympathetic guide. Assigning without motivating, closely related. Failing to keep track of the slow students. Slow students aren't going to have a tap bell on their desk, go, bing, 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 I'm slow. It doesn't work that way. What happens with slow students is they fall behind, and there they be, and you need to, part of your teaching technique, keep tabs on the slower students and identify which ones are struggling. Another one is thinking for the students, doing too much thinking for the students. We already talked about that in our Mount Everest thing. From the Seven Laws of Teaching, here's what teaching is. Teaching is arousing and using the pupils' minds to grasp the desired thought to be mastered. Right? Using the students' minds. If we do too much thinking for the students, what we're doing is we're doing the same thing that happened at the city park in Spokane a number of years ago. I went to the duck pond, and there was this huge sign that said, "Do not feed the ducks." Well, that's why people go to the duck pond. I mean, you know, their own bread, right? And they had a big write-up on this signboard that too many people are feeding the ducks, and the ducks get fat, and they can't fly south. And last year, this is true. Last year, it cost Spokane $120,000 or $130,000 to get these ducks in a car and drive them down to Utah somewhere. I wish I'd have known that. I'd have done it for half that. But the same kind of thing can happen to your students. You can actually make a fat duck that can't fly. You can actually do that in sincerity. Here, ducky, ducky, right? What you really need is this bread. It's, you know, and we do that by doing too much of the thinking for the students. I read to you the definition of what teaching is. Teaching is using the pupil's mind. What is learning? Well, learning is thinking into one's own understanding a new truth or idea. See? That's what teaching and learning is. All right. The third one here on our overarching list of pitfalls is poor planning. There's a lot of ways that good teaching and good planning go hand in hand. I'm going to read to you just a little bit from this book. Here's a quote about failing to allow the unexpected. If you think your schedule is established to stay, and if you think you know the exact standards you will use to give your students their A, B, and C's, you might be in for a big surprise. Think of teaching as a little like farming. Sometimes a farmer has to make allowances for rain, frost, salesmen, and cantankerous cows. Farmers and teachers do not always get what they want when they want it. Right? So allow for the unexpected. Don't let that upset your day. Here's another part of maybe poor planning is worrying too much about classes, worrying that you're not going to have enough to say. The best antidote for this, I'll just give the antidote as I see it, is just keep your eyes wide open and be an observer of life. If you observe life, you're going to have enough to say in class. That's about the way it works. Early in my teaching career, I remember one teacher at an institute similar to this going like this. He said, "This should be the teacher." He said, "This is an antenna. And on top of this antenna, reaching up, is a big eyeball." And it's doing this all the time. All the time it's doing this. And if you are that teacher with a big antenna on top of your head and an eyeball on top of it, you know what's going to happen? You're going to have plenty to say in class. You're going to be a good teacher. It's true. Here's another pitfall, is not planning in enough detail. So you might look at the lesson, the math lesson, let's say, that is about using reciprocals of fractions. Here we go again. And you go, "Oh, yeah, yeah, yep, yep, yeah, yeah, done." Okay, now you're prepared for that class. And there are classes you can indeed do that. There are, especially if you talk for a number of years. What you really need to do, though, before you get too secure in your yeps, is the student work. some from each section. Can you do the student work? And if you're doing this, if you haven't done the student work, I'm not saying 100% of it, but if you haven't done some from each section, several of each type of problem, this thing of detail sneaking up behind and biting is a real possibility. Another part of poor planning is spending too much time on peripheral activities. Before we came here on this trip to Oregon from Montana, Jeremy looked over the van. Yeah, he checked the oil and he did other things that good mechanics need to do before you go on trips. And then he also washed it. But if he would have spent a lot of time washing the van and waxing the van and then undercoating the van and then blacking the tires on the van, and then while he was at it, go ahead and dressing up the spray paint in the rims again, all these things perhaps are okay and valid to do, but what we're doing is spending too much time on peripherals and not realizing this thing's just about to go out of run out of oil. What's going to happen? Well, there's going to be some clunkings and some frustrated people. Class time, study time, your personal preparation. We're talking now about the time after, whatever, after 3 o'clock and before 8 the next morning. So much depends on focusing on the right thing. Keep the main thing, and then do the main thing. Okay. And the last step we're going to talk about today is ineffective discipline. This is a big one. This is one that causes teachers to quit teaching. And it's the inability of some to maintain order and discipline in a classroom that keeps some boards from inviting a teacher back the next year. So as it relates to ineffective discipline, don't be afraid to quietly, firmly, calmly maintain discipline in the classroom. And the students might not always like you for that. That's okay if they don't always like you. It's not your fault that the school board provided desks like they have, that they need to sit in for 6 hours a day, 8 days a week, and, you know, just stay the course. Stay the course. Postponing discipline for later. Several problems. Number one, there are the majority of your classroom, we're not teaching in public school. We're teaching from good, solid, stable homes for the most part. But the majority of students in your classroom, they really want you to be in control. They really want you to address those small discipline issues. And when you don't do it, it can cause resentment. And you can lose respect. And the whole thing can just sort of, it can happen like that. When you must eat a frog, in terms of Brian Tracy, when you must eat a frog, just go ahead and gulp it down. Eat that frog. Don't procrastinate. You procrastinate on discipline issues and it almost never gets better. There may be a time when you can say, well, we'll just wait because you don't know. And if it's a problem, as was said earlier somewhere in this conference, if it's a problem, it'll come up again. And you can deal with it when the issues are more clear. But look, folks, if it's the first week of school and you called for class, and Gerald back there is still boring holes in his pink pearl, all right, it's time for Gerald to hear something nice and gentle and firm out of teacher. All right? It really is. Because you know what's going to happen next week? He's going to be eating his pink pearl. Or, you know, whatever, when he's supposed to be preparing for classes. This is the way it works. Nip it in the bud. Take care of it. Here's another problem that teachers sometimes experience with discipline. They over-lecture instead of disciplining. It is true that we should give students warning. And we need to say, no, we only sharpen our pencils when we dismiss for recess. You should have enough pencils at your desk, as we said at the beginning of the year, have enough pencils at your desk to carry you through each study time, and so on. Right? It is true that we must speak our expectations. But there comes a time that we need to move beyond speaking. And now we're kind of back to where we had been. Right? Sometimes there's things that need to be moving other than the teacher's lips. We need to realize that verbal reproof does bring the wise back into line, but There again, sometimes we need to get up and do something about it. I'm going to read again. To cure yourself, remember how as a student you admired the strong, silent teacher who moved ahead with discipline? Think about how disappointed you were with the teacher of whom the student said he talks and talks and doesn't do anything. I think our experience has been broad enough to recognize the wisdom in that. Another one perhaps about ineffective discipline would be trusting the students too much. There's a certain amount of suspicion that you need to have on your class, some but not too much. If you just think that you can go out to the office, you don't have to copy papers at the beginning of the day like most teachers do, because your students are well behaved. You can copy those papers when they're having study time. You might be trusting your students too much. You really might. Little angels, though they appear, they might do things undercover. That's why the Bible says watch and pray. It's okay for teachers to watch while they're praying. Right? Keep your eyes wide open. You might be surprised what you see. One teacher decided to watch and pray after someone gave him a tip to watch. One boy was doing handstands while he was having the prayer. Right? So trust your students, but not too much. All right, let's talk a little bit about first-year teacher advantages. This is not on your form, but I would just say that one of the advantages of a first-year teacher as relates to pitfalls and potholes is that you can't hit them all. There's plenty of them out there to hit, but you can't hit them all. More seriously, a first-year teacher typically is willing to learn and be led. There's a little more willingness there to learn and be led. When I was about 5 years old, my dad decided this family needs more work, and he's going to build a greenhouse. So he built one 30 feet wide and 130 feet long, and he filled it up with hydroponic tomatoes. And that's where I learned the basics of work and life and sweat and other noble things like that. Learned how to be a noble son of toil, whatever. In order to know how to run that greenhouse, he went for a 3-day conference down to Florida, and he came back with a big, thick, green 3-ring binder. And if you did everything in that book when you're supposed to do it, you would never fail and you'd have tomatoes to sell. That's basically true. The first 3 years, when I think about the greenhouse, I think of Dad with his nose in that manual. Right? And periodically, he would take pictures of the plants and he'd send them back to the training center and they'd say this, they'd say that, make this adjustment, make that adjustment. 3 years into it, he decided, I don't need that anymore. And he put it away. And instead of making 22,000 pounds of hydroponic tomatoes that year, we made 15. Another first-year teacher's advantage is freshness. You're there learning with the students. And there's a freshness that goes along with that that some of us who have been around it a little bit longer struggle to maintain. Another one is friendliness. You aren't suffering from the hardness, the hardening of the attitudes or arteries or whatever. Yet, some of us, as Zig Ziglar says, we need a checkup from the neck up because there's some stinking thinking that develops with being around in the classroom too long. So you bring the friendliness that doesn't come along with that. And the last one is simply sympathy. It's much easier to make the journey back to the days when you were a student, when you're a first-year teacher. All right, the takeaway. Awareness of the potholes and the pitfalls is the first step at avoiding them and providing a smooth ride. Stop and look. Listen and pray much. That's it. God bless.